So I am excited, as I've been doing all summer, to keep kind of moving forward on our current series of talks. We've been spending, every talk I've done this summer has been touching on this thing, and we've called this series When the Bible Comes Alive. And the basic thought of this is I used kind of some experiences from my own life, struggles that I've experienced in approaching the Bible, and struggles that I've heard many other people. As a pastor, you often, unsurprisingly, somebody hears you're a pastor, kind of their experiences of faith are quick to come to conversation. And this is by no means a complete picture of the struggles we come to the Bible, but I were touching on kind of two basic things that I have gone through, which is what I call two pitfalls. And on one side, it was depicted by much of my early life, which is a sense of reverence for the Bible, which I think is good. A sense of like the Bible is this holy and important thing. But the pitfall I experienced there is a sense of reverence around the Bible prevented me from asking questions. It prevented me from, I think, asking good things. I was too quick to just accept and swallow things that were usually told to me, or too quick to look at my initial read of something and say, well, that's what it is. Because there felt like a sense of inappropriateness in asking hard questions about it. And that led me eventually kind of directly corresponding to what I experienced in much of my early adulthood, which is a sense of this Bible is an antiquated and unhelpful text. As much help as that is there is easily offset by as much damage as I see. So I'm just not going to look to it as something to speak into my life. And I'm very thankful for much of my life since then, where I found kind of a middle ground between those two. Something that we are talking about in terms of a informed and thoughtful engagement of the Bible. And my experience is in that middle ground, the Bible has come alive to me. It has become the tool it is for me today, this tool that leads me and helps me into life, where I find connection with this God that is bigger than me, and I find myself brought out of my smallness into something much larger, into community with other people. And so our hope is that this series, just hearing us talk about some of the things that were turning points in the Bible for us, could be helpful for you as we come here on a Sunday in particular and listen to how the Bible might help us each week. And, you know, when you think about this kind of conversation, you know, it's not a surprise that you begin to think about what are some of the worst experiences I've had with this. And to me, a lot of my worst experiences with the Bible, I think, come down to what I would say is being trite. Both things that were said to me that were trite, or sadly enough, many times that I have said to other people that were trite. You know, I think about seeing somebody in suffering and saying something along the lines of God works in mysterious ways. Or seeing somebody talking about a painful and terrible experience in their life and saying the words of, God has a plan. You know, I can think of the countless times I heard some kind of trite platitude when I was talking to some religious person about my brother. And they were just trying to reassure me that it was part of God's plan when I'm processing the challenges around him getting meningitis and losing his hearing at 1 year old and spending the rest of his life now deaf. Or I think about a woman I knew when I was younger, and I remember she was sharing some of her financial struggles and people reassuring her that, like, God will provide, God will be there, only a month before she was evicted for not being able to pay rent. Or I think about last week, I love hearing trite sayings in the world of sports. It's like one of my favorite things in the world. I don't know why, but there's something about like a professional athlete getting paid millions of dollars who then like gets traded to another team who pays them millions of dollars and talking about how like it is God's plan in their suffering. There's something trite about, or like a football player talking about how God is gonna be for us because he has a plan for my goodness, and so we're gonna go out there and have a victory. And if there's somebody on the other side who also believes this is God's plan, they're wrong, or I don't know. But there's something very trite that I experience in professional sports when we talk about some version of God kind of working out for our good. But I think the truth is, this finds a special life when it comes to, you know, religion and Bible stuff. But this, I think, is just true of all of us. I think, regardless of our experiences of background, there's a fair share of kind of the stock phrases of, you know, every cloud has a silver lining. Now, I think you can tell from my words that I can get pretty cynical about these kinds of things. I think what's true from most people that know me is I can often get downright snarky when it talks about this kind of stuff. And as I've grown over, I think one thing that's probably true about anything about my experience of growing up as a person is recognizing that snarkiness and cynicism isn't actually serving me. And I think that it's strange because I think about these cliches and I think about these things that I would tend to be snarky about and think about the things I say. And when I take a step back and say, well, why did I say those things? Or why did that person say that thing that I look at now with such cynicism and say, well, that's just not true, or that was such a trite thing to say? I look back and I think they're not terrible people. I was not a terrible person when I said these things. I think the reality is this world is complex and we often feel out of control. And we look around and we see how unimaginably complex life is. We see how unimaginably complex the world is. And I think very reasonably we say, I would like to feel a sense of order to this all. I would like to feel like I understand what's going on even in the midst of it. There's a sense of reassurance when that happens. You know, I think this is absolutely true for me when I try to understand the world around me. This is why I somewhat obsessively will look into researches and studies. What is the latest thing that's come out of sociology and psychology, human behavior, understanding the worlds we live in? I love spending time in there, and I think there's something each time I learn about human behavior and each time I learn about society, there's like this little part of me that feels like, well, I understand it all a little bit more. That makes the chaos of my day-to-day life feel less hard. I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think that this is something that deserves to be mean to somebody or cynical towards somebody for saying something like this. I think, frankly, when I think about my own life, my sense to try to understand the world and in turn feel some control over it is the genesis of, I think, why I studied theology, the Bible, why I'm a pastor today. It was in pursuit of, I want to understand this more. And I think there's a sense of somehow I will feel safe if I can wrap my head around this. Yes, things are hard, bad things happen, I can't explain it all, but if I can wrap my head around it, maybe I'll protect myself a little bit better. But despite my hope for simplicity, and in contrast to many of the trite phrases that I referenced in the beginning, I've often heard those in reference to the Bible. I've often heard these trite sayings in a quick quotes. I grew up in an age of memorize this Bible verse. That was a part of my childhood. And often these kind of trite things that felt easy to poke holes into found life there. But as I've kind of spent more time and tried to approach the Bible in a thoughtful and informed way, as I've tried to approach my faith, my experience of God, in a way that I think embraced a little bit more of the mystery, that was more about engaging with a living God and less about understanding him. You know what I've discovered, and what I've loved discovering, is that the Bible is not trite at all. The Bible is not this platitude of simple sayings. When you read it for what it is a nuanced and complex, and it is powerful, and it is dynamic. And I think that feels immensely comforting to me because so often in my life today, I recognize I don't actually have much control in making the world less complex. And I spent much of life trying to figure out how to do that. But the truth is, I don't need to, because the Bible resonates with the complexity of life. The Bible resonates with how hard it is to navigate this thing. And when we look at it and when we read it in context, it is not a collection of trite sayings. It is a collection of fully nuanced and complex and powerful stories that become these great tools for allowing us to navigate life. You know, I want to look at this together here today to talk about how powerful, how the Bible came alive to me when I stopped trying to take verses, when I stopped trying to take stories and walk away with the Aesop fable conclusion. What is the one line trite saying that makes sense of this whole passage? and rather said, what is the complex and nuanced reality that this is trying to lead us into, and how can that be helpful to me today? And I want to look at, for the sake of our conversation today, I want to look at something that I actually have used in trite platitudes to other people in the past. I have used this verse in a desire to comfort people. And I think it's a helpful way for us to look at how actually when you read this verse in context, it is anything but trite. And the truth is, we could spend 9 years looking at passages from the Bible that have been summed up in trite sayings and recognize how it is not trite at all. But for today, I'm going to zoom in on this one. This is from the Old Testament prophetic book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is a prophet speaking to Israel. God is giving him the words to deliver to Israel here. So if you want to join in, this is Jeremiah 29, verse 11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. I mean, I think it's pretty easy to say why I liked this verse, why this was a good one for me to hold on to and deliver. I like what this is saying. God has plans for me to prosper. That is really awesome. And the truth is, I believe that about God. I do. And this is often a quoted verse that I hear and I have said when we're trying to encourage somebody in life. There's a sense of like, hey, you're going through something hard or you're feeling lost. I want to read you this passage to encourage you that God has a plan to prosper you and not to harm you, and a plan to give you a hope and a future. And I think that it is great. I think that is a nice thing to say to people. And I think in what it's saying is a meaningful thing. And I don't actually necessarily disagree with anything that's true. And I don't think that what it's saying on its surface value is untrue. However, as I mentioned, I think we as humans have a desire to try to oversimplify things, to make things a little too neat and tidy, to fit into a box that doesn't match up with life. You know, I can remember being 16 with this particular passage and having a friend that was struggling with depression and telling her these words as a comfort to her. I told her in the midst of her sadness, in the midst of her struggle, that God has a plan for her to prosper. And I think in the midst of that, I told her, you know, God's going to use this in some way. God, this is somehow God has given you depression because he has good for you. And I think unsurprisingly, that felt trite to her. Saying her struggle with mental illness was somehow God's desire for her left her feeling distant from God, not closer. And I think the truth is, it's because my initial experience of Jeremiah 29:11, and my desire to feel like, oh, I get this. I just need things from the Bible that I can just quickly get and understand, build my concepts around it, and I'm good to go into life from there. No need to actually interact with the living God because I have these statements, these concepts. And I think the truth was, it felt like this passage felt like a security blanket to me. God has a plan for me that is good. So any suffering I'm experiencing or any suffering anybody else is experiencing, it's eventually going to end, and then God is eventually going to bring them into flourishing. But I think a simple assessment of the world, I think a step back and a look at your own life, I think it makes that a tenuous truth. A plan to prosper. When we look at worldwide poverty, hunger, inequality, I think it feels tough to feel like that as an absolute and simple statement holds up. But I don't actually think that in Jeremiah 29, God is promising that. And I don't think he's promising that to us either. And as we've been talking about throughout this series, I think a thoughtful and informed engagement with the Bible will allow this to come to life. And I think what that means, as we've talked about in the past, is we have to read this in context. And I think in many cases, and in this case, historical context will help us. So this whole section of Jeremiah right here, Jeremiah is writing to the Israelites. It's not the Israelites chilling out at home. It's not the Israelites that are sitting on their own kingdom with prosperity and success in their life. No, in this period, Jeremiah is writing to the Israelites while they are in exile in Babylon. They have been forcefully taken from their home in Israel, as the map shows, and moved into Babylon. So on the base value, exile sounds terrible, taken from your home. It sounds terrible. But the suffering that they experience, I think, is something that sometimes we can miss, because their home is not just a place. It is everything to them. You know, in our individualistic culture, we sometimes can miss this. You know, perhaps if you come from a more collectivist culture, you can help us understand it, people like me that didn't grow up in that. But home is core to identity. Where you are from is core to who you are. And so not only are they physically taken from the comforts of life, they are removed from the source of identity. They are far from it and with no clear path back. And that is where this drops in. We're hearing these words. If we think about a God that is trying to reassure them in that, I think what is true is the Israelites would have had almost a singular focus on what prospering looked like. Prospering would look like God freeing them so they can return to Israel. That is the concept right there. So with the historical context of seeing what's going on, that God is saying these powerful words in the midst of them in exile, we jump back into this passage and consider a different context, the context of the passage itself. The Bible is not little verses that are just popped in by themselves. They are collections of writings that are to be read as a whole. And we just have to read this whole chapter to see that maybe some of our initial read of this has some questions. I think it's quite interesting when we look at verse 7, just a few verses before what we read. Jeremiah says to them, this people in exile, "Seek the peace and prosperity of the city which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper." Yeah, I just could kind of imagine what it would have been like to hear that. You are in another world that you have been forcibly taken into. And you're told to invest in that city for it to prosper, because you'll prosper too. You know, if this passage was just trying to reassure the Israelites, it's all going to work out, you're going to be okay, why on earth tell them to invest in the city that they're in? You know, if God wanted to deliver kind of a simple and a trite message, it would have been pretty easy to say something along the lines of like, "Don't worry, guys, it's going to be okay. It's hard right now, but it's going to be better." But that's not the case. And we see in a moment why God says to invest in that city. If we continue reading the verse just before what we read, in verse 10, this is the verse immediately before the promise that we read in the beginning. God's words don't come across as trite. God speaks to the Israelites like they're adults. In verse 10, he says to them, "You will only return to Israel after 70 years are completed in Babylon." What that means is understanding lifespan at that age, 0% of the people originally reading this will be alive when they return home. They will die in exile. So he says, invest in the city, care about the city, because you want it to prosper, so you will too. And in 70 years, you will return. AKA, as in, you yourself will not. And then he says, "I have plans for you." And I think with all that context, I think we see actually, and this is what I think is helpful in reading the Bible in context, is that I'm unable to hold on to that same kind of trite truth, which is, when I'm going through something hard, it's all going to be okay because God has a plan for me. But the truth this is saying, I think, is more powerful because it will stand up in actual reality. And as we read this context, as God's speaking to these people in exile that won't ever see their land again, and he says, "I, God, have a plan to prosper you." It is not a false promise that everything will be okay and it will sort itself out, or that God will make all things work out for you in your life to see. But rather, it is an example, one of many examples we see in the Bible, of God bringing life comfort, hope to people in the midst of suffering. He's not lying to them and giving them some comforting false platitude. He's being honest and straightforward about the challenges they will face. However, that even in the face of those challenges, even in the 70 years where you are still in exile, which none of you here will see the day you return, in the midst of those, they can experience life, hope, and connection. Their suffering and struggle is not a sign that God has left them, but rather we find an invitation to see that God is close to them in their struggle, in their suffering. And I think when we read this on those terms, and we read about a plan to prosper them, cannot mean that the circumstances of their life get better. I think that the implications for us today are actually even more powerful. God has life for us right now, each one of us here. That doesn't mean the circumstances of our life are going to get better. Now, I go back and I think about my brother. And I can't tell you how many times I had a religious person tell me that him being deaf is just all, it's all part of God's plan. And I can't tell you how many times I prayed that he'd be healed, that this is part of God's plan, he's going to get healed, that like you'll understand it all in the end. And honestly, I can't tell you how many times I was angry on behalf of my brother. I was angry at God and at life for failing him. And as I read these words as a trite promise, that God has a plan for him to prosper, and I looked at him and I looked at all of his peers that he developed growing up deaf, the vast majority of which never finish, even go into a college education. Those words felt trite. But when I read these words in context of a people who die in exile, I actually look back and recognize that would have been an incredibly comforting message. That what does it mean that God actually has good for my brother, even if his hearing is never restored? What does it mean that God has a plan for him to prosper, even if this never happens? And I can look back in context of that and see that in the midst of the struggle, I was so frequently offered hope and comfort in the midst of it being hard. For maybe slightly lower stakes, I think about a desire I have now, which is to own a house one day, which is somebody, you know, in my generation is a desire that is not as easy as maybe it once was. God does not promise me that it's all going to work out and that my circumstances are going to change. I don't think this is a promise that I'm going to prosper in that way. But that doesn't mean that he is not offering me something. He's not offering me what I long for in a home today, in my current place. You know, I don't have a home. I live in an apartment. But I can feel at home. You know, I have found that in the mornings when I pray, I often feel a sense of warmth, acceptance, safety. I feel like this is my place. Really, all the things I long for in a house. So do I really want a house, or do I want a place that I can feel at home? Hope tells me that I can feel at home even if the circumstances of my life don't mean I get a house. Those can happen. And I think that is much more at the heart of what God is promising us. You know, there's a psychologist named Dan Gilbert. He's done some pretty well-known research, gave a TED Talk a while ago that was, I think, one of the most like seen TED Talks in TED history. And he studied the science of happiness. And in short, what he found was that humans overstate the value of circumstance on happiness. That a human's basic kind of modus operandi is to think, I will be happier when my circumstances pan out. You know, when I find that romantic partner, my life will be what it is. When I get this new promotion, when I finish school, when I lose weight, when I get to this next stage of life. And what he found through a whole slew of studies and researches is that we vastly overestimate the effect of those things on our happiness. We think, once I get that perfect pair of pants, I'll be happy. And then we get those perfect pair of pants, and the effect on our happiness is vastly overstated in our brain from what we expected. However, our emotional reality, which is how I experience life, has a massive effect on our happiness. So it's not necessarily that our circumstances have changed, but how we experience our circumstances. You know, like the Israelites that are spoken to here in Jeremiah will not have the specific circumstances that they have attached their dream to come true. The people that receive this will not return to Israel. They will not get their land back. But the longing they are looking for, the longing they want in a land, that sense of identity, those parts that are not circumstantial, those deep needs that they're feeling that all humans have, that sense of provision and care and affection, that is what God is meeting. You know, I may never have the job, spouse, home, money, body I want. Like, those dreams for my life may never come to fruition, but I can still find life. I can still find depth and meaning, the kind of depth and meaning that I would normally associate with getting the job, spouse, home, money, and body that I want, even if those circumstances never come true. So if I never lose weight, am I doomed to unhappiness? If I never find my perfect job, am I doomed to unhappiness? If I never have a home, am I doomed to unhappiness? I don't believe that God is waiting for those things to pan out before he meets us. I don't think God is waiting for us to get a better job. Like, you know, all that love I have for you, you know where it's waiting for you? It's in that management position. Do you know that sense of belonging and connection and healing that I talk about? It's when you lose 20 pounds. No, I don't think that's how it is. I think he has actual good for us right now in our current life. And I just want to take a step back. Like, how much would that change how you lived? To know that you are loved, to know that you are cared for, that you have companionship in the midst of your current life. And I don't want to make it sound like I think changing circumstances are bad, nor do I want to say like praying for different circumstances are bad. I think I have tons of examples. I think of kind of a painful and ironic example of my mother going to a trip with her church to South Africa and praying for and seeing a child's hearing restored who was deaf. Like, praying for those things, I'm not trying to dissuade from those. Nor am I saying all circumstances are the same. We should absolutely pursue better circumstances for our world. But what I am saying is God wants us to experience life and connection now, in the meantime, not just in a future version of life. And if we bank on things working out in order to be happy, if we bank on things working out in order to receive the care and provision God has for us, I think we are going to constantly walk through life feeling disappointed, feeling like statements like Jeremiah 29:11 is trite because it's not true. Or we can see what it's actually promising and say, holy crap, we have a God who loves me and wants good for me, and he offers that to me daily in the midst of my circumstances. And surely he does want me to work towards and help me in finding new circumstances if my current ones are bad. But the message of Jeremiah 29 is not that the current circumstances of life will get better, or that following Jesus means we avoid or escape suffering, but rather that with God, we find company, companionship, hope, life, and fullness that we long for in our current life. You know, the problem with reading the Bible and coming away with trite statements is not that they're never true. I think God is mysterious. I think God has a plan. It's not that they're not true in any way. The problem is when we take those statements and try to make them wholesale, and we try to use them to pretend like the world is more simple than it is. When we try to use those as a way to comfort us by knowing more. I feel safe because I understand. I don't think that's our task in life. And I think that if it is our task, we're going to find ourselves falling short. Because the truth is, how God meets, helps, guides, and works with us is complex. It is different for different people. It does not fit neatly inside the box. And when I read the Bible, that feels abundantly clear. What is going on with one person and how God is meeting them is radically different than with another person. Because guess what? What happens in exile Babylon is a heck of a lot different than what's going on in Paul in the Roman Empire. It's very different realities. And the beauty is, that's why I find the Bible so helpful, is because it acknowledges those. It's in the messiness that we find that God is alive. And he's dynamic. And he actually meets us in the complicated corners of life. We don't pretend they don't exist. We don't say, I don't ask those questions. Or we don't give dull platitudes to assuage the feelings of anxiety we have about hard questions. No, God meets us in the midst of hard questions. And if we come to the Bible expecting it to do what it's supposed to do, which is resonate with the challenge and complexity of life and the world, I think it invites us into interaction with a living God. It's not about creating the checklists to make sure, oh, I got it figured out. It's not, hey, what is your understanding of the 7 points of theology? It is not, do you have all the right categories figured out? Because guess what? If that's about, what the heck do we need God for? No, it's about this wonderful, wonderful tool, a collection of writings telling stories of peoples over hundreds of years and the way that God showed up in their lives. Guess what? So he can show up in our life. And in a moment, I want to pray that we get to experience that together. But I want to give some kind of, this, you know, as much as I talked about, this isn't about big ideas and pictures. What I said was kind of really big ideas and thoughts and stuff. So I want to offer something concrete that I have found really helpful, that many people I know have found really helpful, which research tells us is immensely helpful. And one of the number one ways I think we put ourselves in a position to find God with us every day and every moment in the midst of complexity and not being trite to ourselves or other people is what I experience is the rhythm of praising God in every circumstance. So to be clear, God is not insecure. He does not need us to reassure him that he is cool. He's not like some needy friend that's like looking for us to like, I don't know, I don't think I look very good in this. You're like, you look great in it. You're like, oh, thank you. No, God doesn't need us to reassure him. It is because praising him in every circumstance is amazingly good for us. When we practice thankfulness, thanking God for whatever on earth there is to be thankful for, we actually begin to appreciate our current life more. Our happiness, our fulfillment, and our connection becomes less dependent on the circumstances of our life. You know, and this is also not inviting us to call bad things good. It's also not saying praising God is like, well, thank God for that terrible thing that happened to me. Or saying that God was behind the terrible thing that happened to me. We're just saying that in every circumstance, in every moment of life, there is something for us. And he is with us, that there's no situation that we're in that he has nothing for us. And so it's training yourself in daily life to say, wow, I really don't want to go to work today. I hate what I'm doing today. I'm in a fight with my spouse. I'm not sure how I'm going to pay all my bills this month. But you know what? This cup of coffee is quite delicious. Jesus, thank you so much for coming into this world and inventing this deliciousness of coffee. The way that that orients ourselves to not say, I'm unhappy today because work sucks, this relationship is tense, because my circumstances aren't what they are. My apartment's way too small. but rather saying, okay, where is there happiness in this world? And I think my experience and what research tells us and many people I know is building in a routine of being and this is not a general thank you. And I think the big difference between a general thankfulness and a specific thankfulness is a general thankfulness is like, thank you for coffee writ large. Specific thankfulness is, thank you for this cup of coffee that I am drinking right now. Thank you yesterday when I was watching that TV show that was super entertaining and it brought my mind into a different place that felt wonderful. Thank you for that friend that came over yesterday and that moment that I felt like he really saw me. Those specific things that we name change the way our brain works. It changes the things we look at, and it banks our happiness less on our circumstances. And so that's my suggestion, is to try that at some specific time each day. So like over coffee every morning, on your commute every day, before you go to bed at night, at your lunch break, just taking 5 minutes to say, what are the things that I can think about to be thankful for? And if you can speak them aloud to somebody else and that context makes sense, even better. But even if you're taking a moment to say it to yourself or journaling it, it's one of those things that I'm like, do that for a month and come back and report what happens. Because I think that you will find that your experience of things, it will feel a lot more like there is a God who has a plan for you to prosper. So with that said, I would love to invite everyone to stand with me, and I'm going to pray here. Jesus, I just acknowledge my desire to feel like I understand things. I acknowledge my desire to make the world feel more orderly. I acknowledge my desire to feel like I at least understand why what happens to me happened to me. And Jesus, I don't shame myself for that. I don't say that that's bad. But I look to you in the midst of that. Not to give me answers, because I actually don't think answers are as much what we need as we need connection. That I don't necessarily need to understand everything, but I do need to feel understood and seen and cared for. And Jesus, I pray right now that that would feel accessible to us. That you would feel alive to us. And for anybody that really feels like their brain is caught up in the loop of, I'll be happy when, or it will be okay when, that we've tied some sense, or, you know, like, I'm going to pursue that when, or I'll deal with that when. You know, I pray right now that we would stop punting to our future selves, that your love and care, your challenge, your desire for growth, your desire for wholeness, your desire for us to be and experience life in a deep and full and meaningful way is not something you like in future self. That's something you want for us today. And I pray that we would feel that sense of acceptance. Even right now, as somebody right now who's a little overweight, it's not like I'm happy once I lose these pounds. Even in the midst of what is true today. And Jesus, for those that do, like, there are circumstances in your life that are not good. I pray that you would help us walk through that. That you would bring freedom, that you would bring change where change is needed. Restoration where restoration is needed. Healing where healing is needed. But that our sense of acceptance wouldn't feel contingent on those things being true. And help us live in that complicated middle ground of both pursuing change, but not saying any good is dependent on it.